Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. Ahead of tonight's results from the New York primary races, we'll begin with the subject that was most debated between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, and that is who would be tougher on Wall Street or more effective in reining in the big banks. William Cohan, a former senior Wall Street investment banker and New York Times bestselling author of Money and Politics, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World, who writes a biweekly column for the New York Times' deal book section, Street Scene, joins us to discuss how Wall Street feels about how they are being portrayed in this presidential campaign, and whether if Donald Trump wins the Republican nomination, all of Hillary's promises to clean up the street in response to Bernie's attacks on her ties to bankers will be forgotten and forgiven as Wall Street flocks to support her over Trump. Then we'll cover today's opening of the UN General Assembly's special session on drugs and speak with John Walsh, a senior associate for drug policy and the Andes at the Washington Office on Latin America, who coordinates their drug policy program that supports more humane and effective drug policies in the Americas. We'll discuss how Russia has led the effort by a number of countries to maintain a punitive approach in spite of the failure of the war on drugs, while other nations are trying to move the focus to harm reduction. Then finally, we will speak with Iraq expert Juan Cole, a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan, whose latest book is The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. He joins us to discuss the crisis of confidence in the Baghdad government that is mired in dysfunction and corruption, and whether the addition of more American troops announced today by the Pentagon is mission creep. And joining us now is William Cohan, a former senior Wall Street investment banker for 17 years at Lazard Frere & Company, Merrill Lynch and J.P. Morgan Chase, as well as a New York Times bestselling author whose books include Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World, House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street, and The Last Tycoons, The Secret History of Lazard Frere & Company. He's a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and has a biweekly column in the New York Times deal book section, Street Scene. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Cohan.
Thank you for having me again, Ian.
And I'm interested, Bill, on how the street sees the Bernie Sanders-Hillary Clinton attacks and counterattacks on each other and on Wall Street. And it's pretty clear that Bernie Sanders has moved Hillary to the left, if you will, in terms of Wall Street. And I'm wondering whether they see that is a problem, or whether they don't like being vilified around the country, which has clearly happened, or basically, do they not consider Bernie Sanders a threat or a sufficient threat? So you're there on the street, so give us the street scene on the Bernie-Hillary battle over Wall Street, which will be resolved in, what, about an hour or so, 2 hours from now.
Well, the polls close here in about in an hour or so, and then we'll know pretty much right thereafter. But I would say, Ian, that number one, Wall Street is made up of human beings too. They do not like being vilified. They do not feel that the vilification that they have gotten at the hands of Bernie Sanders, and to your point, precisely correctly, he has moved Hillary to the left, dragged her, probably kicking and screaming, to the left on these issues, and they don't appreciate that either. So they are not happy with either of the Democratic candidates. On the other hand, they can't stand any of the Republican candidates either. They cannot. They despise Donald Trump. I mean, not only for the reasons that many people despise Donald Trump, because of the things that come out of his mouth, but they also despise him because in the past they've done a lot of financing business with him, and he has four of the companies that he's been involved with have gone into bankruptcy, and they've lost a lot of money as a result of Donald Trump, the businessman, and I don't think that they appreciate having lost that money, and their memories are long. So the combination of those two things when it comes to Donald Trump make him a complete non-starter on Wall Street. Ted Cruz is, I think, in their view, a zealot, a right-wing zealot, and they're not interested in him either. They don't mind, per se, John Kasich, but they don't see him as a good bet. They think he can't win. They see him, unfortunately, as a loser. And so as much as they don't like Hillary Clinton and the way that she has basically vilified them, either because that's what she believes now, which I don't think anyone believes, or because Bernie Sanders has hauled her to the left to keep herself in the race for the Democratic nomination, I think that she, to them, is now the best of a bunch of terrible and sickening choices for people on Wall Street. So if you ask them now, on the eve of the New York primary, which she should win handily, I think they, Wall Street, would by and large support Hillary Clinton, although they wouldn't like it. They're not happy about it.
So is that to say then, Bill, if Donald Trump becomes the Republican nominee, and he'll probably do well in New York, and probably next Tuesday as well, and he keeps saying he's going to get the 1-2-3-7, which would get him the nomination right out of the gate. But, you know, he says a lot of stuff that you don't necessarily should believe. But my sense is that if he's the nominee, doesn't that give Hillary Clinton a free ride? I mean, you'll have Wall Street people supporting her. You'll have Republicans supporting her. Even the Bernie people who don't like her will be so alarmed at Donald Trump being president, they will probably support her. So would that mean that all of this rhetoric against Wall Street would simply go away because the consensus against Trump would be so great?
Yes. In answer to your question, yes, all that rhetoric goes away. All the rhetoric, everything that she is saying now that sort of implies, you know, negative things about Wall Street, or how she's going to be tough on Wall Street, or how she's going to, potentially consider breaking up the banks or putting taxes on transactions or any of that stuff. That is all just things that she has to say so that she can, you know, try to keep up with Bernie's rhetoric. Once Bernie goes away, that'll be the end of that. I think that, I'm no electoral map expert, but I would think that a Hillary Clinton versus Donald Trump a race for the White House in November would be a landslide for Hillary Clinton, considering that Trump has, you know, alienated women. He's alienated blacks and Hispanics and other minorities. He has alienated Wall Street and every businessman on the planet. I can't, you know, there are going to be people who will vote for him. We've seen that. But this is going to be an electoral landslide for Hillary Clinton, in my judgment, unless, of course, you know, she suddenly is indicted because of these emails, or she has a meltdown in the face of things that Donald Trump will say about her on the campaign trail. And we know he will say a lot of things that none of us will quite believe, but he's going to say them.
Well, let's take the other alternative then, Bill Cohen, that one that Bernie doesn't go away, not that he'll necessarily get the nomination, but that he'd still be a powerful presence at the Democratic Convention, and that Donald Trump, that the Stop Trump movement from the so-called Republican establishment does succeed in stopping him, and therefore you would have a Ted Cruz. So that's a different constellation. What's your sense then of, because one of the things that the analysts keep saying is that the Bernie people are pretty fired up and pretty loyal to their candidate, and Hillary's going to have a hard time winning them over. So that would therefore indicate that he'll be keeping her feet to the fire on Wall Street.
Yes. I mean, I think that, you know, he may very well be a presence at the convention, but I think after tonight, after the results come in New York, I think it's going to be a convincing victory for Hillary in New York. And I think then, you know, then the rest of the primary season sort of favors Hillary. I think that doesn't mean Bernie's going to go away because he's got a lot of money. But I think that the sort of the threat and the rhetoric about Wall Street, Hillary will, when she sees a clear path to nomination, which I'm sure she already does, but you know, after New York, maybe even after California, I think it'll be pretty clear that she's going to get the nomination, she's going to be the nominee, she's going to control the convention, she's going to control the agenda at the convention, and, you know, she may even say some things at the convention that are tweaking Wall Street, but once that convention's over, and once it's, you know, her versus Ted Cruz or her versus Donald Trump, You know, she's going to immediately forget all that rhetoric. She's going to go back to being the candidate, the Democratic candidate that Wall Street loves and has given $10 million in speaking fees to in the last few years. And, you know, all will be forgiven, and she will be by far their preferred choice, especially if it's Trump or Cruz. And they, you know, that rhetoric will die down, and it'll be like it never happened. And, you know, in, you know, Bernie's not going to be the vice president. And, you know, that'll be kind of that.
But is it possible that at least Bernie's moved sufficiently far away from Wall Street that she wouldn't be able to bring back her husband's people like Summers and Rubin?
Yeah, I think you're right about that. I think the days of Summers and Rubin are over in terms of important economic and cabinet positions, but there are sort of enough Rubin and Summers acolytes who are sort of their descendants who are very much these days still around the Hillary flame, and I think would be in an excellent position to get positions in her administration that did not require a Senate approval, something like the National Economic Council, which does not require Senate approval. I think it might be harder for a Wall Street guy to get become Treasury Secretary, even though she might want that, because of not being able to get Senate approval in this environment, certainly not in a first Hillary Clinton administration. But there are a lot of positions that don't require Senate approval that I think will go to her Wall Street loyalists. And there are a fair number of Rubin acolytes who are very much all still around Hillary Clinton, giving her a lot of money, bundling a lot of money for her, and giving her economic and financial and strategic advice on a regular basis.
So the obviously she doesn't want to release the transcripts
right.
of her Goldman Sachs speeches, and Bernie Sanders did sort of try to smoke her out on that, and she tried to turn the tables by saying, release your tax returns, which he did. And,
which he did.
And there wasn't any smoking guns there, but there's clearly a smoking gun here in terms of her Goldman Sachs speech. My understanding is from Goldman Sachs employees that were there for the speech, they've said that it was sort of a rah-rah speech where she sounded more like a Goldman Sachs managing director giving a motivational speech than a politician or certainly an independent politician. So, but I mean,
I did my own reporting on this subject, mm-hmm. did a piece for Politico about this, and my contacts among people who were at the speeches, and she gave three of them. Number one, they were not even speeches, Ian. She got $225,000 apiece, and they weren't even speeches. They were question and answers, which is, you know, a very nice way to earn $225,000 for an hour. She mostly spoke about kind of world, this is what I was told, world leaders, world affairs, and and much less about Goldman Sachs. She did give a speech at a Clinton Foundation event that was for this Goldman Sachs women's group, where she did was motivational. That actually is available to be watched, the video of that online, so that'll put you right to sleep. As far as the question and answer period, what I'm told is that the reason that she is reluctant to release these transcripts, aside from the reason that she feels she's being singled out, is that she said some embarrassing things about world leaders, or things that could be perceived as embarrassing or too frank about world leaders in that session, and so she doesn't want that to be on the public record, and less of an issue about saying great things about Goldman Sachs.
I see. So at the women's Goldman Sachs meeting, presumably she was addressing Ted Cruz's wife.
Well, Ted Cruz's wife, you know, was like a asset management, a wealth management person in Houston. I think this was in New York at the Clinton Foundation. So unless she flew up for that, probably not. But I'm telling you, you can watch that speech online, and it'll put you right to sleep. It's so boring, and so non-substantive, and even her trying efforts to be rah-rah, you know, fall flat.
So in other words, she wasn't paying the piper with a sycophantic speech. What she's really concerned about is the gossip about world leaders. And
so I'm told, yeah, but I mean, you know, yeah, I haven't seen the transcript of the speech, so I'm not sure.
Right. Well, I guess we'll wait and see in the next hour or so what happens in New York. And of course, the consensus amongst the punditry and the predictors is that it will be a good night for Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, but we'll see whether that pans out and whether the other scenarios that we discussed in this interview also pan out. And I thank you very much for joining us.
It's always a pleasure to speak with you, Ian. Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with William Cohen, a former senior Wall Street investment banker for 17 years at Lazard Frere & Company, Merrill Lynch and J.P. Morgan Chase, as well as a New York Times bestselling author whose books include Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World, and House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street. He is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and writes a biweekly column for the New York Times deal book section, Street Scene. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back covering today's opening of the UN General Assembly special session on drugs. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is John Walsh, the Senior Associate for Drug Policy and the Andes at the Washington Office on Latin America, where he has coordinated their drug policy program since 2003 in support of more humane and effective drug policies in the Americas. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Walsh.
Thank you, Ian.
And starting today, April the 19th, going through to the 21st, the United Nations General Assembly are holding a special session on drugs and the global war on drugs, if you will. There's an interesting article by Kofi Annan at the Huffington Post. It said, just quickly to read a bit of it here, the war on drugs has not succeeded. Some estimate that enforcing global prohibition costs at least $100 billion a year, but as many as 300 million people now use drugs worldwide, contributing to a global illicit market with a turnover of $330 billion a year, one of the largest commodity markets in the world. So that seems to sort of state the, it may be stating the obvious, but would you agree that that's pretty much the picture that we should be looking at?
That is the picture that we should be looking at, and I think for most people it is obvious, but for many people their job requires them to ignore or deny the obvious, and I think that explains a lot of the lack of attention to the consequences of the drug war that we're seeing play out in this UN special session, and the sort of circling the wagons approach around the punitive prohibition. That said, there are many, many countries who are expressing their dissent about that approach. And I think when we look back at this particular UN process, we'll probably see some building blocks for a more humane approach being set down.
Well, my understanding is in the lead up to this UN General Assembly special session on drug policy, that the Russians have been particularly obstructive, that the consensus is pretty much, a global consensus is that we should move towards harm reduction and away from punitive policies. But the Russians, even though they've got a terrible drug problem and a terrible HIV/AIDS problem, which is related to intravenous drug use, they nevertheless are back in the Stone Age, it seems. What explains the Russian position?
Right. I think you've explained it well. And the unfortunately, Russia is not alone in that sense. So Russia is not standing alone against the rest of the world's committed to a harm reduction approach. That's not to say there's a consensus in favor of Russia's view either. The truth is in the middle, that the consensus, if there ever was one, in favor of a punitive prohibitionist approach, that has clearly broken down. But there are some countries on one side who would like to reinforce and even double down, and that would be Russia. But there are other countries, many in Asia, who feel that the goal of a drug-free society is one that we should still strive for at any cost, including imposing the death penalty for drug crimes. Indonesia spoke up very, very tough in favor of the drug penalty today, for instance. So Russia is the strongest and most powerful voice in there, and they have gone out of their way to stifle the process, as you indicated. The truth is they're not alone, but on the other side are countries who are completely unwilling to imagine that their drug policies could in any way be hampered by a belligerent approach on the part of Russia. And that's where the debate lies. So the question is, will there be a new human rights-based public health approach that's endorsed by the UN, by all countries? No, because there are many who fundamentally would like to stick to punitive prohibition and suppression. But there are countries who are making clear that this is intolerable for them, and they will, on their own, push for the UN to be more outspoken in a progressive way, but also have to take matters into their own hands within their own borders.
So when Kofi Annan says in his article at the Huffington Post, why I'm calling to end the war on drugs, when he says that I believe that drugs have destroyed many lives, but wrong government policies have destroyed many more, is there evidence to support what he said?
There's decades worth of evidence, because the focus on suppressing supply clearly doesn't work, especially when there's a growing market and demand. So the supply suppression, especially when it involves military or militarized policing, in and of itself ruins, if not ends, lives. And the response of criminal organizations isn't to lay down and surrender, but rather to up their own firepower. So we've seen the expression of war on drugs has become a real war on drugs in many, many countries. You know, the most obvious for those, you know, close to our border is Mexico in the last several years. So you can imagine that's for Mexico is the tip of the iceberg in terms of the tens of thousands of deaths, murders, and mayhem. And then there are tens of thousands of people across the globe incarcerated in inhumane conditions for, in many cases, very minor drug crimes. So the extent to which prohibition and our ultra-aggressive enforcement has literally ruined lives, families, and communities is hard to overstate.
Well, there should be some evidence, surely, here in the United States about this dysfunctional war on drugs, particularly the focus on marijuana, given that many states have legalized marijuana, and Colorado in particular. They stand as a test case of what happens when you legalize recreational use of marijuana. And as far as I can tell, there's no evidence that the legalization of the use of marijuana, particularly for medical purposes, has led to an increased marijuana use by teenagers. But conversely, because so many doctors in league with Big Pharma have been giving out prescriptions for OxyContin and other opiates, and then when their patients get hooked on it, and then they finally realize that, maybe they can't keep writing these prescriptions. And maybe the DEA, because, you know, doctors, when they write prescriptions for these banned drugs, the DEA does have a record. So they stop writing prescriptions for OxyContin and other opiates. And then what does that person that's hooked do? And we're talking about middle-class white people, by and large, in this country. They turn to heroin. And heroin deaths have tripled in this country between 2010 and 2013 from heroin overdoses. So the evidence is pretty clear that, you know, where you legalize something that's not particularly harmful, doesn't lead to widespread addiction. But on the other hand, when you criminalize drugs that shouldn't be prescribed in the first place or prescribed indiscriminately, that just leads, in other words, Big Pharma has become the gateway to heroin addiction. Isn't that what the evidence says?
The evidence very clearly shows that. And in the case of Big Pharma, I think for, on the part of doctors who were prescribing with good intentions to help relieve pain, but a drug that is, you could say, overkill and not really indicated for chronic pain management. And then when stricter controls were put in place, which they needed to be, what did people turn to and what was ready for them? And in part because it was cheaper, is illegal heroin. And I think to really extend your point, what some research has shown, and it's tantalizing evidence, and I think there's a real good basis for thinking that it will prove itself in more states and more jurisdictions over time, where there is medical marijuana availability in a robust way through dispensaries. In those states, there seems to be a real, a much lower level of opioid dependence and overdose death. Exploring what the causation there is a critical research point, but the idea, going back to your initial point, that legalizing marijuana somehow is going to cause the sky to fall in is clearly not happening. The converse, the idea that you can legally regulate and take out of the hands of criminal gangs and into the hands of legal enterprise and the state and do it in a way that doesn't magnify the health risk, but to the contrary, removes the criminal sanction and the disaster that over-incarceration is. That's a huge boost. And I think that's one of the most interesting sort of subtexts of this UN meeting, is the fact that the United States, which has been the chief designer, sort of architect, and cheerleader of these global prohibitionist treaties, is now, by anyone's lights, except maybe the U.S.'s own, contravening those treaties with respect to legal cannabis. So the U.S. and many other countries are very anxious to avoid that discussion, because the fact is that there is a lot of flexibility and latitude within the treaties not to conduct a war on drugs, not to criminalize people. And more countries are realizing that they have that latitude, that the idea of a war on drugs is not really required by the treaties. They don't have to do it that way, and are moving towards a public health approach, which they ought to do. But one thing that the treaties don't allow for, and that the world needs to experiment with nonetheless, is precisely what's going on in the United States with regard to cannabis, in Uruguay with its national law, and what Canada is talking about doing, which is creating a legal, regulated approach that can get rid of, undo most of those terrible ills of the drug war, and regulate access in a way that's consistent with public health, human rights, and individual liberty. We think that's the way that the world needs to go with drug policy. I think, by and large, this UN meeting has ignored the primary charge, which was to evaluate what has happened under the drug control conventions to date, and continues to conflate the idea that drugs and drug policy are one and the same. I mean, it goes back to your point at the very beginning and what Kofi Annan wrote. It's not drugs themselves, it's also our drug policies that compound the damage and in many cases create the damage.
Well, let's go through some of the points that Kofi Annan has made. First, this is number one. First, we must decriminalize personal drug use. Now, I've always thought that in many ways semantics have played a very negative role here. When the word legalization comes up, it gets all kinds of people in a lather about the end of civilization as we know it. Semantically, it would seem to be much better. Decriminalization is certainly an improvement on legalization, but what about medicalization?
Medicalization, in some sense, is available under the drug conventions, which limit use of the controlled substances to exclusively medical and scientific. And I think it in many ways it's a big advance to even talk about that, because it acknowledges, which is in the other side of the treaties, to ensure access to medicines with controlled substances that people need for all sorts of reasons. But medical, I think, can only take it so far in terms of the many uses that people do, you know, want to, and in fact, in the real world, do make use of substances that are considered completely prohibited for uses other than medical and scientific. So I think there's huge scope for improving the way that countries allow for access to medical uses, including the drugs that need to be used for pain management, acute, surgical, where most of the world's population lives in countries where access is very limited or zero, and then ensuring that, for instance, in the case of medical and therapeutic uses of cannabis, patients who need it have it without stigma. I think taking it the next step beyond access for patients is what legal regulated markets, for instance, now a drug like cannabis would be.
And the second point that Kofi Annan makes is we need to accept that a drug-free world is an illusion. What's your reaction?
Well, I think it's one of those obvious statements, right. But I think it's so important because, you know, I would add it's a dangerous illusion, because it's the kind of illusion that if we somehow become convinced that we could create a drug-free world, which I think is, frankly, a dystopian illusion, that if it's somehow within reach, then we should do whatever it takes to get there. And that sort of thinking is what has upheld and fueled a very repressive approach that ends up violating human rights in the name of drug control. And for decades, really, drug control has sort of looked for and gotten a free pass from any scrutiny about human rights concerns, because the idea is, well, you know, come what may, the drug war is sort of an existential thing for us, and we need to achieve this drug-free society, which is, unless you're willing to close your society down completely and move away from the ideas of an open society and liberal values, it is a non-starter, and it should be. So I think fighting or conducting drug policy with that as your goal is a recipe for disaster, and that's exactly what we've done.
So the third point by Kofi Annan is, third, we have to look at regulation and public education rather than the total suppression of drugs, which we know will not work.
Right. So we've talked a bit about regulation. One of the concerns expressed about a legal regulated approach rather than relying on prohibition is that it will inevitably increase levels of use and therefore dependence, and therefore it will be a disaster. And I think there's nothing about a legal regulated approach that suggests that prevention and education and treatment and a public health approach don't go hand in hand. In fact, to the contrary, every country that talks about regulating the market knows that they want to do so in tandem with, and can probably be more effective in terms of their prevention, education, and treatment. Why? Because the stigma of being a user will be gone. You're not going to be criminalized, because the dishonesty of prohibition in terms of substances that are different than, and in many cases less dangerous than, already legal substances is gone. So we can have honest messages about education, and we can reach people with those honest messages rather than lie. So I think the idea that a legal and regulated approach somehow is inevitably a surrender to The bad consequences that can come of problematic drug use independence is just not borne out by reality, and doesn't match with the expressed intent of the countries who are moving in this direction now.
Well, the fourth and final step that Kofi Annan recommends is to recognize that drugs must be regulated precisely because they are risky. I think pretty much you've covered that as well. Unless you have a quick word, I just want to do a wrap-up now in terms of this special session, the United Nations General Assembly's special session on drugs. What's your sense of what the takeaway will be, given the divisions that you've outlined between those that recommend harm reduction and those that want to stick to the failed policy of punitive approach?
I think that both sides there will find something to build on. The sort of, we call them retrograde prohibitionists who want to double down on repression, I think will feel that they stood their ground and defended their approach, and they will insist on the flexibility to pursue it. On the other hand, I think that as difficult as the negotiations have been, the countries that are really seeking the UN to come out loud and clear in terms of a harm reduction and human rights approach by no means got what they want in these negotiations, but they do have elements in both the outcome document and in terms of the statements that heads of state and ministers are making that point the way towards that more humane approach. If I stand back and say, is this a satisfactory outcome overall, given the horrors of the drug war, the real trouble that does come with drugs and our inability to do something about it because we're stuck in prohibition in a punitive way, I'd say, no, this is a failure. If I look at the realities that we're confronting progressive countries going into these negotiations, I think they worked hard to achieve some things that we now need to build upon.
Well, John Walsh, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Sure. Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with John Walsh, who's a Senior Associate for Drug Policy and the Andes at the Washington Office on Latin America, where he has coordinated their drug policy program since 2003 in support of more humane and effective drug policies in the Americas. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back speaking with Iraq expert Juan Cole about whether the addition of more American troops announced today by the Pentagon is mission creep. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Juan Cole, a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global Americana Institute. He's also the author of the blog Inform Comment at juancole.com, and he's the author of Engaging the Muslim World, and his latest book is The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, Juan Cole.
Thanks, Ian.
And the U.S. is increasing the number of its personnel in Iraq by another 217, bringing the number up now of full-time military personnel to 4,087. But that doesn't include the hundreds of special operation forces, many of whom are operating in secret. So the full inventory is not totally clear. But do you see this as mission creep?
Well, I don't know. Certainly, it's a bigger commitment than President Obama initially envisaged, and it is a deepening of the American commitment in Iraq. yet again. You know, most of the troops that have been sent so far have been based in headquarters, and so have not been actually out in the field much. And the big news here, I think, is not that they're sending a couple hundred extra troops, but that they are now widening the scope of their role. So there's talk about them going out further, closer to the front lines, being embedded, still as advisors rather than combat troops.
And apparently most of them are associated with the deployment of Apache attack helicopters and high-mobility artillery rocket systems. But in general, there's been a clear inability of the Iraqi army to take Mosul from Daesh, the Islamic State. And there's also been a persistent fear that the irregulars, the Shia death squads, if you will wreak havoc. And it's not entirely clear that the population of Mosul, even though they may not like living under the yoke of the Islamic State, I think they're perhaps even more afraid of being liberated by the Baghdad government that they despise. Is that your understanding?
I think it's, as you say, it's an extremely mixed picture, and there are real downsides to the conquest of Mosul by this Iraqi government, which is strongly colored by Shiite Islam and supported by those Shiite militias. However, it's not entirely clear yet whether the militias will be a part of the Mosul campaign. They were not allowed to go into Ramadi, which was taken by the reconstituted Iraqi army. And that army is showing some signs of being rebuilt. And so, you know, they did have a major success in Ramadi. And they also recently took a strategic but smaller city, Heat, in Al Anbar province from Daesh. Again, this was primarily an Iraqi army enterprise. So I think one problem with the campaign against Mosul is it's just a much larger place than these others that I've been talking about, a much more challenging place to conquer, a largely Sunni city. And I think that for the Iraqi army to do this alone is just not possible. It collapsed too badly. It hasn't been sufficiently rebuilt. So it's going to need help. But the Americans are now talking more about deploying the Kurdish Peshmerga militia in Mosul rather than the Shiite militias. And I think this is a way of their avoiding too much influence from the Iran side. And as part of this announcement that they're sending in more troops, they also did announce $400 million in aid to the Peshmerga and training. So I think that's the American plan for Mosul.
And this $450 million that the U.S. is giving to help resupply the Kurdish Peshmerga, it's also going to pay their back salaries that go back months. I mean, you know, the Kurds are often praised as the only American ally that's any good in that region in terms of taking on the Islamic State. But they're led, in effect, by two rival mafias, neither of which are particularly savory, are they, in terms of the government there? And the idea that the U.S. taxpayer has to pay the salaries of the soldiers because their own leadership won't pay them doesn't speak well.
That's right. There are real problems of governance now in Kurdistan. You spoke rightly of the division between the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan and the Kurdistan National Democratic Party, but led by the president of the Kurdistan Regional Authority, Masoud Barzani. But, you know, now the KDP and Barzani really have more or less taken over. It's much more of a unified political scene with the decline in health of Jalal Talabani. And so the situation is that Barzani had been elected president, but we're now past the point where there should have been new elections. And so he's still in office, even though his term has expired, and no new elections have been held or seem to be planned. So he seems to be evolving into one of these seedy Middle Eastern dictators presidents for life. There's wrangling between Barzani and the central government about the share of oil revenues. There are, as you say, arrears in government bureaucracy and in the military, the paramilitary of the Kurdistan regional government. All of these are big problems. However, despite those problems, the Peshmerga, the Kurdistan militia, is among the best fighting forces on the ground in the region. And it did have already a number of important successes against Daesh, including the conquest of Mount Sinjar and the town of Sinjar. And essentially, the Peshmerga have surrounded Mosul from the north. And I imagine that the Americans are hoping for a pincer movement with the Iraqi army coming up from the south and the Kurds from the east and the north crushing Daesh in Mosul. Another big problem with these military campaigns is that they destroy the cities that are supposed to be saved. And so Ramadi, you know, is a city full of ruins. Tikrit, likewise, and much of the population of these places flees, and in some cases hasn't come back. So, you know, Mosul was like Houston. It was originally a metropolitan area, at least a city of 2 million, and it's now probably down to about 1 million. So many people have run away from Daesh. And more will leave with this campaign. So, you know, we're seeing the de-urbanization of northern and western Iraq, which is very bad for the Iraqi economy and for the Iraqi people. So many new refugees are being created. So I'm sure that this Mosul campaign will be painted if the Iraqi army and the Peshmerga succeed. As a great victory over terrorism and Daesh, but we should keep in mind that for local people, as you rightly indicated, this is a very fraught situation.
Let's turn to the government in Baghdad that, as I say, is pretty much despised by the Sunni in the north, who have essentially been driven out of Baghdad. And while they may not like Daesh, they seem to dislike the Baghdad government even more. And the Prime Minister al-Abadi, he seems to be under a lot of pressure since he came to power in August of 2014. Just yesterday, April the 18th, thousands of Iraqis marched to the Green Zone to protest this government's mythic, amazing corruption and dysfunction. And Muqtadir al-Sadr, the leader of the Mahdi, a fairly radical Shiite militia, has given them a deadline, which is today, April the 19th, for the government to appoint non-party technocrats to help fight this systemic corruption in this government. And, I mean, my sense is good luck.
Well, yes, the Prime Minister, I think, is trying to do the right thing. You know, the way the Americans set up Iraq when they were occupying it, those ministries were awarded to political parties. You know, I read, you know, as a school child about the old spoils system in the American government in the days of Andrew Jackson and until really the late 19th century, where the parties that won the election would insert their people not only at the level of the cabinet, but as employees of the federal government. So they would switch out, you know, and that's how Iraq is run. So one party would get the Ministry of Health, and then all of a sudden all of the hospital administrators will be from that party, and another party will get the Ministry of Agriculture and so forth. It's a spoils system, and it's obviously very bad for governance and is itself a form of corruption, but then it encourages more corruption. And Muqtada Sadr and his people, who have, by the way, operated in this way themselves in the past, are now have turned against the spoils system, are demanding that possibly because they have a smaller party and the spoils are going elsewhere, they're demanding a more technocratic government where the cabinet ministers don't represent the parties and aren't reward. You know, their positions aren't a reward for party support. And so Abadi, the prime minister, has appointed a technocratic cabinet and submitted it to parliament. And the Speaker of Parliament, Salim Jabouri, seemed inclined to go along. But then the parties in parliament are upset because they don't want to lose the spoils. And they switched out their speaker and elected another man as speaker. But then Jabouri refused to step down, so parliament now has two speakers. And then Jabouri dismissed parliament, prorogued it, although some rump members of parliament are claiming that they will meet on Thursday. So not only hasn't Abadi's technocratic reform cabinet been approved by parliament, but parliament itself has kind of collapsed in the process of attempting to decide whether to approve it.
So the role of the U.S. then, as you mentioned, in creating this system of spoils, obviously has been criticized in this election year by the Republicans, who blame Obama for the mess in Iraq and not Bush and Cheney, which is pretty breathtaking in itself, with the exception, I might add, of Donald Trump, who at least has named the real causes of this catastrophe in the Middle East. But there has been some criticism of Obama, even though he had no choice but to pull out, because his predecessor, George W. Bush, made the deal for the U.S. to exit. But there's an Iraqi official that's worked as an advisor to all U.S. governments for some time now. I can't remember his name, but he was on a program that I saw where he made the case, and he argued against all the incredibly stupid things that Bush and Cheney did in the Green Zone. But he said that the worst mistake that Obama made was not standing by the real winner in the elections and allowing essentially the party in power to steal the elections. So what's your sense of that, whether there was a missed opportunity there in terms of Obama's tenure?
Oh, I don't think that it's fair at all to blame Obama for this situation. In 2010, there were elections in Iraq, and the system that the Bush administration set up in Iraq is a very bad one, and it regularly produces what is technically called a hung parliament. There is no natural majority in Iraq. So the Shiites are a slight majority, but then they're internally divided. So there are usually two Shiite blocks. There's a Kurdish block, and then there's a Sunni Arab block. So it's by ethnicity. And in order to have a government, once you have an election that returns these four blocks to power, at least two of them have to get together to make a majority. And they all hate each other. So in the summer of 2010, it was revolving chairs going back and forth to try to make an alliance. And the Sunni Arab bloc was actually led by a Shiite, but a secular man, Ayad Alawi, who was an old CIA contact in Iraq. And he got two seats more than one of the other parties and maintained that by the Constitution he should have been appointed prime minister. But he would have led a minority government. He had no partners. He couldn't put together a coalition that would give him 51%. So he never could have been assured of passing any laws. And there is a provision in the Iraqi Constitution for initiating the fall of the government with a vote of no confidence. So I don't think it was plausible for Alawi to be prime minister, even though his party got slightly more seats than any other, just because he couldn't find a coalition partner that would take him to 51%. On the other hand, the Iranians intervened and got the Shiites together and convinced them to put aside their disputes, and Nouri al-Maliki then was able to craft a majority in parliament, and he got the Kurds to join in as well. So this has nothing to do with Obama. It's just parliamentary politics of the sort that
Ian, you understand probably better than most of us Americans. But, you know, in America, we make our coalitions before the election. In parliamentary systems, you make them afterwards.
So then, apart from historical revisionism and this kind of enormous memory lapse over responsibility for this catastrophe, which just goes on. I mean, you're a student of Iraq and probably one of the world's leading authorities on the country. It just gets worse and worse. I mean, how much pain and agony can this country endure?
It is a horrible situation. I think we often forget how horrible it is. You know, millions were displaced by the Bush occupation, and now more millions have been displaced by the rise of ISIL. There's a severe ethnic division in the country, which, you know, it's not that that there were no ethnic divisions before Bush, but his way of proceeding created this power vacuum and played on ethnicity. And, you know, certainly the U.S. administration of the country bears some blame for how the place has fallen apart. And for provoking, you know, the kind of resistance movements that turned into Daesh. So it is a country full of refugees, of widows and orphans. There's evidence now that literacy is slipping, education is slipping. Although it did have the advantage of an oil income, now the price of petroleum has fallen from $110 a barrel to 40 or so. And so there's going to be a huge budget deficit. And you know, I was in Baghdad about 3 years ago. I couldn't tell that it was an oil state. I mean, most oil states, they have these gleaming skyscrapers and too many new malls and all this kind of almost frivolous investment. There was no sign of any of that in Baghdad. I think there was one new mall being made, and the place looked dilapidated. It looked as though nothing had been built since 1980.
And so much of it has been destroyed. And now we're hearing that the big dam is about to break. We've heard this for some time, but apparently you could have a massive disaster in that country where tidal waves sweep down from the north, just from outside of Mosul, all the way down the Tigris.
Yeah. That dam is not reliable. And unfortunately, because of the rise of Daesh, it's very difficult to get the engineers in to make the proper repairs. Right. One of the if there is a successful Mosul campaign, one of the side effects of it is that you might be able to fix that dam before it breaks.
Well, Juan Cole, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me in.
And again, I've been speaking with Juan Cole, who's a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan. He's also the author of the blog Informed Comment at juancole.com and the author of Engaging the Muslim World. And his latest book is The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. And again, I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.